Let's get this show on the road.
Commanding you to bow down.
I'm on your side.
By branding you as a rebel.
But you're not.
A traitor.
This isn't freedom. This is fear.
We are not the government. The government is not us.
This is the
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Dino Files, episode number 53. Man. I didn't release a show last week because, I did that live stream and then I got busy. I had a very busy week. So, we're back doing it now. If you want to go listen to that live stream, I was on the Rollo and Slappy show. That was streamed on Monday in lieu of a regular show for me. I just did a show with them, so you can find their podcast. Probably drop a link on Twitter or something. I might put it in the description. In the show notes area, a link to their podcast. It was a fun discussion. Very, very fun discussion. And I can't wait to go back on their show. They've got a great show. Listen to that episode and listen to everything else they do, because it's awesome. All right. I was looking for some legislation earlier, and it's all pretty boring right now. There's nothing outrageous happening at the moment. We'll see how things go as the week goes on. But most of the legislation that's being looked at now is pretty tame. So there's no interesting legislation today, but we do have an interesting article from Quillet. This was posted on December 7th. Academics mobbing of a young scholar must be denounced. The latest victim of an academic mobbing is 28-year-old social scientist Noah Carl, who's been awarded the Toby Jackson Newton Trust Research Fellowship at St. Edmund's College at the University of Cambridge. Rarely has the power asymmetry between the academic mob and its victim been so stark. Dr. Carl is a young researcher, just starting out his career, who is being mobbed for being awarded a prestigious research scholarship on the basis of his peer-reviewed research. While getting a position like this is normally a time for celebration for junior academics, Dr. Carl has gone to ground, unable to defend his reputation from libelous attacks, as he's been instructed not to talk to the media. 300 academics from around the world, many of them professors, have signed an open letter denouncing Dr. Carl and demanding that the University of Cambridge, quote, immediately conduct an investigation into the appointment process on the grounds that his work is, quote, ethically suspect and, quote, methodologically flawed. The letter states, quote, we are shocked that the body of work that includes vital errors in data analysis and interpretation appears to have been taken seriously. Yet the letter contains no evidence of any academic misconduct. It does not include a single reference to any of Dr. Carl's papers, let alone any papers that are, quote, ethically suspect or, quote, methodologically flawed. International academic community, they embedded a tweet there, sorry. Drawing on disparate fields of research in psychology, psychometrics, and sociology, Dr. Carl's papers have been peer-reviewed and published in journals such as Intelligence, Personality, and Individual Differences, The American Sociologist, Comparative Sociology, European Union Politics, and the British Journal of Sociology. His papers have been cited 235 times since 2013. Much of Dr. Carl's research focuses on how intelligence and other psychological characteristics affect beliefs and attitudes. Papers include Leave and Remain Voters' Knowledge of the EU After the Referendum of 2016, Cognitive Ability and Political Beliefs in the United States, and his most cited paper, published in Intelligence in 2014, Verbal Intelligence is Correlated with Socially and Economically Liberal Beliefs. So this is basically a piece that was written on Quillet saying that this dude's being mobbed and that people signing on to continue mobbing him. Other academics signing on to continue mobbing this guy. Oh, they explain why. So why all the fuss? Dr. Carl's crime is that he has defended intelligence researchers who've written about the taboo topics of race, genes, and IQ, and argue that stifling debate in these areas is likely to cause more harm than allowing them to be freely discussed by academics. It appears to be this, and the fact that he spoke at the London Conference of Intelligence in 2017, alongside some of these researchers, although he did not himself speak about race, genes, or IQ at that conference, that the basis for the accusation made in the letter that he is guilty of pseudoscientific racism. Oh, God. It's always race and IQ. Like, this is one of those things that some people want to research, and it should be researched. I mean, finding at least correlations between certain things can tell you more about the world that you live in. And if there happens to be correlations between race and IQ, then we should know what those correlations are. Hell, it might even help to discredit the notion of IQ, which is, like, fine, because I frankly don't like it very much. I don't even know what mine would be, but I don't like the idea of a written paper test being used to judge how smart people are. I don't think that works. There are enough problems with people taking tests that I don't buy it, personally. But that's the kind of thing that needs to be looked at. But you can't really look at these types of things if you're not allowed to find these correlations. So, I just find this disturbing. The mob is at it again, and I'll take the opportunity to point you toward, I did those two specials, the first of which was about the book So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and I recommend you read that book. Listen to that special if you feel like it, but definitely read the book, because that book is all about the mob going after people who seem to be politically incorrect on the surface and ruining their lives very much on purpose. This is one of the reasons that I can't stand people like this. It's one of the reasons that I call them hostage takers, is because what the mob does is it takes someone's livelihood hostage and then executes them whenever they feel like it. That's what Cernovich did with James Gunn, and that's what many, many people have done with other conservatives. You take someone's livelihood hostage and then execute it. What is someone supposed to do in the face of that? But definitely go read that article on Quillet. It is much longer than what I said, or than what I've read thus far, but it's not too terribly long. It's actually, it's probably a mid-size, low end of the mid-size piece on Quillet, so definitely give that a read. On to the news from Fire. Thefire.org, published on December 10th. Future of the First Amendment survey shows need for increased civics education in high school. So there's this organization called the Knight Foundation. They do a Future of the First Amendment survey. They do basically a survey to find out people's thoughts on free expression and how much they know about it. From the story, last week, the Knight Foundation released its 7th Future of the First Amendment survey. This survey measures the attitudes of high school students and teachers toward issues involving the First Amendment across time, including freedom of expression and freedom of the press. High school students are supportive of the First Amendment. This year, only 26% of high schoolers think the First Amendment goes too far in the rights it guarantees. 26%. That's over a quarter of the respondents. That's high to me. This is down significantly from the 45% of high school students who answered this question in the affirmative in 2006. 45%! What the fuck? Oh my God. At Fire, we believe that taking a class that includes a First Amendment in its curriculum is important for all high school students, so we provide resources for high school students and teachers. These resources can impact the attitudes of high school students. The Future of the First Amendment survey backs this up, finding that students who report taking a high school class dealing with the First Amendment are more likely to personally think about their freedoms than those who have not taken such a class, 35% compared to 27%. These findings show the importance of beginning education about the First Amendment and civics at a young age before students reach college. Although FIRE defends the civil liberties of college students and faculty, we recognize that it is important to begin encouraging discussions about civil rights and liberties during high school. So, God, a quarter's still very high. For me, anyway. Precisely why democracy is terrible. Right. This is what I hate about this, is the, like, there's... for a hot minute there, and if you've been listening for a while, you know that I am 1 year of probational teaching away from having a teaching license. I've done everything, taken all the tests and all that other shit. I only need a year of probationary teaching and I would have my teaching license. The reason I was going to do that is because I wanted to teach civics in high school. I elected not to, and to instead take the LSAT and not deal with hormonal sociopathic high school students. However, this is exactly the kind of thing that, look, my experience in high school, in a high school civics class, okay, my civics class, my government class was separated into one semester that was civics and the other semester was economics. Now, the person who was teaching me economics in high school was kind of a weird dude, but he was definitely a Keynesian. And the person who was teaching me civics was also a weird dude, but he was definitely, no bones about it, very, very liberal. Which, on the one hand, is fine, because a lot of the conversations about, social issues was a very liberal conversation. We were allowed to, you know, be a little bit more liberal than our town about that. But, man, this dude was... He responded poorly to anyone who school being liberal fake news, right? But that was the thing, was it was a little bit of a surprise, because where I live, it's incredibly conservative. It was at one time the second most conservative county in the nation, right after Salt Lake. So, you know, it was a little bit of a surprise to have a very liberal teacher like that teaching civics at my high school. But he was, and again, on the social topics, it was interesting, but when we talked about actual government, like the role of government and things like that, yeah, he wasn't all that great. He was a very big government guy. It's the first class I read Locke in, though, so I guess there's that much. But yeah, there's definitely... My civics experience, I don't know how much I would have learned in my government class in high school, because I already cared about all that shit by the time I got there, and I was reading books and had already read through the Constitution numerous times, just, you know, getting resources and things like that. I already knew a lot about civics in the United States going into that civics class, so I don't know exactly what I would have come out of it knowing if I hadn't done that. It definitely wouldn't have been as much, but I don't know. It probably wouldn't have been great. I probably wouldn't have known very much about government coming out of it. But it's one of those things that I think it's important, because you can't, if people don't understand what government is and what it does, they can't understand why it's bad. Because they think, people are brought up to think, and civics classes teach, that government is there to protect people. It's what every freaking moron politician says on TV now, or on the radio, or wherever they're doing their thing. They say, my first job's to protect the American people. No, it's really fucking not. Every oath of office that you take says your job is to uphold the Constitution. Now, I'm not a big fan of the Constitution, but we've allowed civics to slip so far that politicians walk around saying, my first job is to protect the people, and it's not! It's just obviously not. And nobody calls them on it. That's how ignorant people are of civics in this country. So, and I believe in most places, because again, government education, what are you going to expect? Government education is shit house 90% of the time. There are very few teachers. Actually, Michael Malice was on Joe Rogan not too terribly long ago, and he talked about it a little bit, and he pointed out, he gave a perfect reasoning for why government education is so bad, and why, you know, it takes like, teachers who are good teachers have to be sneaky about being good teachers. I know that for a fact because my mom is a good teacher. Moving on, more news. This was a, man, this was pretty shithouse. Kevin Hart quits Oscars giving gig. Why is this fucking with me so bad? Okay, let's start that headline over. Kevin Hart quits Oscars hosting gig over past homophobic tweets. Social media mobs win again. Quote, I sincerely apologize to the LGBTQ community for my insensitive words from my past. Actor and comedian Kevin Hart, who was tapped to host the 2019 Oscars earlier this week, resigned that job late Thursday night after social media sleuths dug up his homophobic tweets from a decade ago. A decade ago! 10 years! Fuck me! An Instagram video, Hart claimed that the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences had issued an ultimatum, apologize or lose the gig. Hart initially refused to revisit the issue, which he claimed he had addressed several times in the past. This is not the first time this has come up, he said. I've addressed it, I've spoken on it, I've said where the rights and wrongs were. Hart also criticized those that went looking for such tweets in the first place. Quote, the same energy that went into finding those old tweets could be the same energy put into finding the response to the questions that I have been asked years after years after years, he said. This was a brave stance. Unfortunately, it did not last. At midnight, Hart posted on Twitter that he had stepped down as host, and he offered an apology to the LGBT community. Quote, I have made the choice to step down from hosting this year's Oscar. This is because I do not want to be a distraction on a night that should be celebrated by so many amazingly talented artists. I sincerely apologize to the LGBTQ community for my insensitive words from my past. Congrats, social justice lynch mobs. You win again. That's not in the tweet. That's in the publication. Most of the people I saw on Twitter demanding penance from Hart were journalists at generally left-of-center publications, which makes this something of a left-led lynch mob. For comparison, the previous notable social media pile-on, which targeted Guardians of the Galaxy director James Gunn over his gross child sex jokes, was driven by far-right Twitter personalities Mike Cernovich and Jack Posobiec. Recall that when Cernovich and Posobiec did the same thing, dig up weird comments from a different era of the internet and force moderate modern corporate PR concerns to do their work, they were accused of launching a bad faith smear campaign of retaliation. It will be interesting to see whether those who put Hart in the same situation are capable of reflecting on the similarities. I'm betting not. When Roseanne said something horribly offensive about Valerie Jarrett, she was justly fired, in the view of many liberal commentators. But when Sarah Jeong was found to have tweeted constantly about how much she hated white people, it was questionably described as satire, and nothing happened. She got to keep her new gig at the New York Times. Continuing from the story, I for one was glad that Jeong survived an attempted social media assassination, because there ought to be some understanding that human beings are more than their worst moments on Twitter. And I hoped that right and left could call a truce on finding reasons to get people fired. Alas, the perpetual outrage machine must be fed. For what it's worth, Hart's tweets, like Guns, Roseanne's, and yes, Jeong's, were bad. It sounds like he had some issues with gay people back in 2010. These issues probably stem from his own insecurities. I assert that with some confidence because Hart himself admitted as much. He made it part of his comedy routine. In fact, not that this matters to the woke crowd, even comparatively progressive jokes offend certain unreasonable people when the messenger doesn't fit neatly into the requisite category. Consider this interview Hart did with Rolling Stone in 2015. In 2010, seriously funny. He tells the audience, one of my biggest fears is my son growing up and being gay. That's a fear. Keep in mind, I'm not homophobic. Be happy, do what you want to do. But me, as a heterosexual male, if I can prevent my son from being gay, I will. This leads to vignettes in which Hart reacts to imagined signs of Hendrix's blossoming homosexuality with interjections of, stop, that's gay! Discussing this bit today, Hart says, it's about my fear. I'm thinking about what I did as a dad. Did I do something wrong? And if I did, what was it? Not that I'm going to love my son or think about him any differently. That was an important not. The funny thing within that joke is me getting mad at my son because of my own insecurities. I panicked. It has nothing to do with him, it's about me. That's the difference between bringing a joke across that's well thought out and saying something just to ruffle feathers. Even so, he adds, I wouldn't tell that joke today because when I said it, the times weren't as sensitive as they are now. I think we love to make big deals out of things that aren't necessarily big deals because we can. These things become public spectacles, so why set yourself up for failure? Why indeed? So, I read that entire story. I originally didn't intend to, but it was interesting and well written. Guys, so you've been publicly shamed. Read it. I cannot stress enough how important that book is for understanding the history of this phenomenon, this public shaming phenomenon, and for understanding what kind of reactions people have to it, and to a certain extent, what motivates it. It's very important that we know what this is. Cryptic Cynic and Mr. Sue in the chat, it's hard to believe Twitter's been around that long. I know. 2006 was over a decade ago. Yeesh. That's when Twitter started, 2006. Holy shit, right? God, I feel old. All right, next piece of news. New internal Facebook email reminds us you are Facebook's product. This is from Recode. Your personal data has always been the key to Facebook's business, and Facebook executives, including CEO Mark Zuckerberg, have used access to that personal data to strengthen strategic partnerships and hurt competitors over the years. At one point, Zuckerberg even considered selling users' personal data to outside app developers. That much was clear from a new trove of internal Facebook emails and other documents released by British lawmakers on Wednesday. The documents had previously been sealed as part of an ongoing lawsuit filed against Facebook in California, but were made public by Britain's Digital Culture, Media, and Sport Committee, which collected the documents last week. Quote, I believe there is considerable public interest in releasing these documents, tweeted Damian Collins, the committee's chair. Quote, they raise important questions about how Facebook treats user data, their policies for working with app developers, and how they exercise their dominant position in the social media market. The emails, which mostly date from 2012 to 2015, include conversations from Facebook's top executives about the company's developer tools and data sharing practices before widespread changes were made to limit access to some user data in early 2015. A Facebook blog post says the emails were cherry-picked from a lawsuit to represent only one side of the story. Moving down a little bit, Facebook considered selling user data. One of the biggest misperceptions about Facebook is that the company sells your personal information. In reality, Facebook uses that personal information to target you with advertising, but it holds on to the bulk of the data itself. Back in 2012, Zuckerberg suggested that Facebook charge some outside developers for accessing and collecting data on users through the company's APIs, software that allows Facebook to share data with other apps. If we made it so devs can generate revenue for us in different ways, then it makes it more acceptable for us to charge them quite a bit more for using the platform, Zuckerberg wrote. He suggested that developers could offset these charges by spending money on Facebook ads. Facebook ultimately decided not to charge for this kind of data sharing, but the consideration is a reminder of how Facebook has built an entire business on people's personal information. Down further, Facebook used personal data to strengthen or weaken competitors. Access to the personal information of billions of people has put Facebook in a very powerful position. The emails show that the company used access to that information as a bargaining chip with potential competitors. In some cases, Facebook granted other businesses like Netflix and Lyft special permission to access information that other companies didn't have. In other instances, Facebook cut competitors off. When Twitter launched the video service Vine in 2012, Facebook cut off access to its friend graph, which meant users who signed up for Vine with their Facebook account couldn't see and connect with all their Facebook friends inside Vine, an ability that would have theoretically helped the Vine-created network much faster. In another email Zuckerberg sent in November 2012, he suggested Facebook, quote, enforce our policies against competitors much more strongly. It's not a surprise that Facebook would limit its data sharing in a way that didn't boost up its competitors. It would be more surprising if Facebook hadn't done this. But again, the underlying theme here is that Facebook's competitive business advantage lies in having access to people's personal information, an important understanding at a time when regulatory bodies are likely looking at Facebook's competitive practices more closely now than ever. By the way, that's how you kill Facebook, is you quit giving them data. And that doesn't even mean you have to get rid of Facebook, but it means maybe you encrypt your traffic. Maybe you use an ad blocker and a script blocker on Facebook. Maybe you do all these other, like maybe you use the Brave browser so that the tracking cookies and tracking software doesn't get used on your specific traffic. That's how you starve that beast. Facebook knew there were risks in peddling users' private information. Facebook's Cambridge Analytica fiasco, in which a third-party research firm gained access to personal information of tens of millions of Facebook users without their permission, raised a number of questions about the company's data-sharing policies. One of the most important was whether or not Facebook was ignorant about the risks of sharing user data, or just didn't care about them. Wednesday's email dump makes it look like Facebook didn't really care. In the email from Zuckerberg mentioned above, he acknowledged that making Facebook sharing tools free would lead to abuse. Quote, not charging still means people will overuse or abuse our APIs and waste money for us, he wrote to many of the company's top executives. I still think we should implement some kind of program where you have to pay if you use too many of our resources. It's not exactly clear what Zuckerberg meant by abuse. It's hard to imagine he foresaw that issues like Cambridge Analytica would arise in the way they did. But it's also clear that his concern wasn't what that abuse might mean for users. The fear was that abusing the APIs would hurt Facebook's business. Which, of course, that was the fear. It's a business. What's the takeaway? You could easily walk away from this email dump and think, that's just how ruthless businesses work. That's true. And Facebook has given that it is very, very good. Facebook has proven that it is very, very good at making money from the personal information it collects from its users. But Facebook has always positioned itself as a mission-driven company out to make the world a better place. It wasn't just another win-at-all-cost business, but the place where you post your baby photos and stay in touch with your friends from college. Facebook's product created a level of intimacy that others did not. What we've learned over the past month, from Facebook's dealings in Washington to its relationship with Oppo research firms to Wednesday's email dump, is that Facebook is a ruthless business and your personal data keeps it alive. I'm glad this was posted on Recode, because this is exactly the kind of thing that you would have seen posted on, like, Gateway Pundit, you know, a year ago. Before Cambridge Analytica, this only would have been up on, you know, like, the fifth column. Sites that aren't really mainstream sites. Recode is a mainstream tech news site. So I am very happy this is here. I think Facebook's days are numbered. They're going to do everything they can to survive, but I don't think they can. I think they're still very successful now. Give it a few years, and that is going to be no longer accurate, I think. I think this company is going the fuck away. And for me, it can't happen fast enough, because I fucking hate Facebook. I want Facebook to die almost as bad as I want Twitter to die, and I want them both to die, like, quickly and in a fire. Oh, goodness. So, that's your personal information. And if you'll notice, the reason that Facebook collects all that personal information is so that they can sell ads. This podcast and the Air Network is ad-free, because we don't want you to fill out a survey, so we contact advertisers, and advertisers tell us to read 30 seconds of fucking shit that you're not interested in order to do effectively the same thing, sell your data to advertisers. So, we're not doing it. But we gotta do something, because doing this stuff costs money, and for that, we have this.
Credits will do fine.
It's time for Who Do You Trust? Hubba, hubba, hubba. Money, money, money. Who do you trust?
Credits will do fine. This is the credits. Again, we have the wonderful and glorious Max Ogburn on the Patreon as a producer. Max Ogburn is, he's stuck around for a long time, man. And I'm so grateful for him. You're a god amongst men, Mr. Ogburn. If you'd like to join him, you can do that. There are links at the Rogue File and on AIRAD.io. Alright, let's move on to our main topic of the day. So I'm sure you guys have been hearing a lot about France. The French, these historically incredible rioters are at it again, folks. Oh man, I'm sure you all know about this, but I'm going to get into this a little bit differently. I want to look at it from kind of a different perspective. But yes, the yellow vest protests in France. I was looking at yesterday, I spent quite a bit of time on Twitter refreshing the latest in the yellow vest, but French for yellow vest, which I'm not going to try and pronounce because I'm not going to embarrass myself that way. The latest in that hashtag, and looking at translated, crappy machine translated tweets of what people, French people, were saying about these protests. It's interesting. There seems to be a strange divide, but we'll get into that a little bit later. Let's start with a little bit of background, because everybody kind of knows about the protests after they had already been in full swing for a little bit. When most people heard about it, I think was probably just a couple of days before Macron actually decided to postpone and then originally get and then get rid of the upcoming gas tax hike that was the original catalyst for the protests. However, the protests haven't stopped. And people have pointed out that usually when protesters get what they want, they go home. Which means that the fact that these protests haven't stopped would indicate that these protesters haven't gotten what they want. So let's look into it. Let's figure out what the hell's going on here. Because, oof, man, it's become quite a quagmire. This is from Al Jazeera. Now, Al Jazeera had one of the only really, one of the only timelines that went all the way back as far as I wanted it to go. So, Al Jazeera's timeline, the France Yellow Vest Protest, timeline of unrest. I'm just going to read from their timeline. France experienced weeks of social unrest since massive protests erupted across the country on November 17th. It's been almost a month, guys, and these people are still going. The demonstrators were initially held to protest. The demonstrations were initially held to protest planned hikes in fuel taxes, but have since widened into a movement against the government's economic policies, leaving President Emmanuel Macron facing the biggest challenge of his presidency. Below is a timeline of the Yellow Vest movement in France, and from the first online rumblings against the tax increase to nationwide protests and the worst Paris riots in decades. Viral video. A video posted on Facebook on October 18th quickly goes viral. It shows a woman, Jacqueline Marat. I don't French. Starting that over. It shows a woman, name I'm not going to try, addressing French President Emmanuel Macron. Monsieur Macron, she says, from her living room, and in it she lists the grievances of drivers in the face of the fuel price increase. A petition to bring down the price of fuel is posted online. Mass protests. Saturday, November 17th, is the first day of road blockades across France, with nearly 290,000 demonstrators wearing the fluorescent yellow vest motorists are required to carry in their cars. That's the first thing I found fascinating. All these vests, the reason that they're wearing these vests is because they had them. Because they're, it's like you have to have a safety vest in your car by law. So that's why this is that's why that exists, is because they all just had them. It's not like a specific thing and it doesn't mean anything important. They just had them. That was the first thing I was fascinated to find out, by the way, because God, I was like, what is with this? They're required to have them in their cars. That's why they just had them to go to the protest. The protests are spontaneous and not organized by political parties or unions. The next day, Prime Minister Philippe says the government will not back down. Violence breaks out in the French Indian Ocean island of La Réunion, led mainly by armed youths. The second Saturday, the next protests take place the following Saturday, November 24th. Thousands of demonstrators clash with police on the Champs-Élysées in Paris. More than 106,000 demonstrators are recorded across France, including 8,000 in Paris. Revised official numbers count 166,000. Man, these numbers are crazy for protests. A board meeting. On November 27, Macron offers minor concessions, saying he proposed a mechanism to adjust the tax increase and calls for three-month national consultation. Sorry. Unimpressed, the Yellow Vests call for a new protest on December 1st on the Champs-Élysées. On November 29th, Philippe meets a Yellow Vest protester. A day later, two accept his invitation, but one walks out. On the third day of protests, on Saturday, December 1st, with widespread violence erupting, particularly in Paris, around the Arc de Triomphe and several upscale neighborhoods, the government says some 136,000 people protested across the country. On his return from the G20 summit in Argentina, Macron immediately calls a crisis meeting in Elysee Palace on December 2nd. Philippe meets with political party members on December 3rd. Yellow Vest representatives announce they will not go to a meeting with Philippe, planned the following day, later canceled, as some say they had received death threats. Blockages of roads, shopping centers, and fuel depots continue. Seizing on the momentum from the protests, students start demonstrating over education reforms, disrupting dozens of high schools every day from December 3rd. On December 4th, the government retreats. The prime minister says planned tax increases on petrol and diesel on January 1st will be suspended for 6 months, and hikes in regulated electricity and gas prices will be frozen during the winter. This, I believe, is when most people in the U.S. who know about this found out about it, was when the French government said, okay, fine, we'll wait 6 months. That made major headlines, and up until then, this whole thing had pretty much been ignored. The Yellow Vests reject the moves as insufficient and press ahead with plans for a fourth day of protests on Saturday, December 8th. That was last December. The government fears the new protests could lead to a new explosion of violence, anticipating participation by the far left and far right. 2019 tax hikes were scrapped. On December 5th, Macron announces that all planned fuel tax hikes for 2019 will be scrapped. However, he rules out reimposing a fortune tax on high earners. Farmers say they are planning to hold demonstrations next week to support their own demands. For the fourth day of protests on Saturday, 89,000 security force members are deployed, including 8,000 in Paris. Armored vehicles are also mobilized in the capital. On the eve of the demonstration, yellow vest representatives advise against demonstrating in Paris, where museums, monuments, big shops, and many metro stations will be closed. They did riot. They did riot that day, that Saturday. This was posted before that Saturday. They absolutely rioted that Saturday. It was one of the most impressive riots I've ever seen. God, it's just, it was interesting to watch things unfold on Twitter. I was on Twitter that when it was daytime in France that day, I was on Twitter that night and I was looking at all this stuff going down. It was, man, there's a lot of people doing this. And some people have said that this is like a libertarian or an anarchist thing. And some of the people there are. But that's not a majority thing. I'll get into it in a little bit, but there's no united front on what these people want. I do want to read a couple of other stories. I'm going to go down to like the middle of this short story from Euronews. Violence goes down at Saturday's, not going to try that, yellow vest protests. Interior Minister Castan, let me try that either. Fucking French. Officials estimated that 125, this is about the Saturday, December 8th. Officials estimated that 125,000 anti-government protesters took to the streets all over France, with clashes between protesters and police also taking place in Bordeaux, Lyon, and Toulouse. But security measures this time around were far greater, with 89,000 security forces deployed throughout the country, 8,000 of those in Paris. Interior Minister said that more than 1,700 people had been arrested at the end of the day. The escalation of violence has been stopped, he told a press conference. It's been contained but remains totally unacceptable. Parisian health authorities said that 179 had been admitted to the hospital, most with minor injuries. A protest movement that began over fuel prices developed into an expression of anger over living standards and the policies of President Emmanuel Macron. I'm skipping down a little bit further. The Green Vest movement has also spread to neighboring countries, such as Belgium, where around 400 people were arrested on Saturday at a protest in Brussels. Demonstrations also took place in some Dutch towns. The Green Vest movement also reached American shores, attracting the attention of U.S. President Donald Trump, who suggested the Paris Agreement was responsible for protests. Yeah, he basically just went, neener, neener, neener. Fucking Trump. Okay. So I am scrolling down farther on a Spanish piece that was published on December 5th. Okay. The headline is not this. This is a machine translation in English. Towards a regime crisis in France. If the fire finally catches on the blah, 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 then yes, we will be in the wake of a great French social insurrections that have provided so much oxygen to freedom and social progress in Europe since 1789. Cryptic Cynic in the chat says, without government, who would force drivers to have yellow vests for no apparent reason? Fucking right. It doesn't make any sense. It does not make any sense at all. Yeah. All right. I'm scrolling down a little bit farther in the story, and I'm going to begin reading. Now, on the street, new faces are seen. It's not the political left. It is the normal people, the majority harmed by the blah, blah, blah. And offended by the impertinent verbal incontinence of this president of the rich. People who are beyond politics, who do not vote, or who vote for the National Front, or France, blah, 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 a social revolt for those from below of the majority. France has seen its life deteriorate in the last 20 or 30 years, but mostly white. Peripheral neighborhoods of migrant origin are still absent. If that changes, if the fire caused by the spark initially catches on the blah, 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 then yes, we will be in the wake of the great French social interactions that have provided so much oxygen to freedom and social progress in Europe since 1789. You have to be very attentive to France. The claims have been expanding. In their last expression, they offer a fairly complete catalog of a radical rejection of austerity, privatization, and growing social inequality. Politicians complain that it's very difficult to negotiate with this, and this is the grace and force of the matter. All right. So here's the list of basically demands, and I'm going to read another one here in a little bit. More fiscal justice, which I'm assuming is the wealth inequality bit. A minimum wage of a minimum wage of 1,300 euros net, favor the small commerce of towns and urban centers, cease the construction of large shopping centers around big cities that kill small businesses, more free parking in the city centers, parking, a plan to isolate homes to make ecology by saving the domestic economies, that's a bad translation. More taxes for large companies. Same social security system for all. No more pension reform. No pension below 1,200 euros. So far, these are all very socialist things. Salaries indexed to inflation. Maximum salary of 15,000 euros. Oh, they want to set a salary cap? What the fuck? Protect the national industry. No relocations. Limit temporary contracts. Industrial promotion of the hydrogen car. End of the austerity policy, cessation of payment of illegitimate interest on debt, and combating tax fraud, that the asylum seekers be well treated and that action be taken against the causes of forced immigration, limitation of rental prices, fuck, prohibition on the sale of goods of the nation, dams, airports, things like that, 25 students per class maximum, favor the rail transport of goods. Fucking rail union got it on this. Price maritime fuel and kerosene. So they want price setting. Of course, many things are missing as the French media complex is reacting to this crisis. It will soon appear some fundamental claim to democratize and demonopolize media that today are 80% in the hands of large corporations and billionaires, logically hostile to the interests of the social majority. Oh, goodness. So, all socialist shit. All socialists, at least on this piece. There are, I had it pulled up. I have a million tabs open about this. Okay, I think we've done enough scene setting and digging into things like this. Let's look at the actual numbers. So, did some research, did some reading, did some stuff, and I found that, okay, income tax alone, their top income tax bracket is a 45% bracket. And that bracket exists at income above 153,783 euros. So about 153,800. And that was for 2018. So I'm going to copy this number and drop it in this conversion. Oh, I forgot they use a comma as a decimal. Okay. That's 174,800 bucks. So 175,000 bucks. To get into the, a year, to get into the 45% tax. 45%! That's 5% away from being half of your take-home pay. Now, this is where things get interesting. There are social surcharges. Sorry, I had to scroll around to find this. There's a lot of charts on here. There are social surcharges on here. 5.2.4 of, I'm looking at french-property.com/guide/france/finex-taxation/taxation/calculation-tax-liability/rates. If you can do that URL real quick. I'm just going to read from it. 5.2.4, as well as your liability to income tax, you also need to consider your liability to French income tax by another name, that of the social charges, which you can read all about under social charges. So we're going to click on social. So 5.6.2, social charges rates. A summary of the income on which the charges applicable are applied, either with the current rates as shown below. This can be seen as the rate of social charge differs depending on the nature of the income. So from salaries, investment cap, capital gains, and rents, for CSG, all these things stand for. All these things stand for different social charges. For CSG, that is another 9.2% on salaries, 3.8 payout on pensions, and 9.9% capital gains for CSG, for that, whatever it is that is, abbreviated to CSG. CRDS. That's 0.5% on salaries and on pensions, both directions, and on investments, capital gains, and rents. This is a French word, social, There's a French word followed by the word social. That's 4.5% on capital gains, investments, and rents. Additional contributions is 0.3% on pensions. And this is all additional. This is not, you don't get to choose one of these. All of this applies. It's just broken up by what you're paying for. And then 0.3% from investments, capital gains, and rents. That's another social word, or another French word, followed by another French word. That's another 2% of investments, capital gains, and rents. For a total of salaries taxed at 9.7% on top of your income taxes. 9.7% on salaries, 9.1% and 4.3% on pensions, and 17.2% investments in capital gains. So, let's do the math for the highest bracket. At the highest tax bracket, you're going to be paying 45% of your income plus 9.7% of your income. That is your total income tax. Now, that does not include if you have investments, if you have a rental house, if you have all this other stuff, you're paying taxes on that as well. I don't know about you, but I would personally be averse to paying what would amount to roughly 60% of my income to the fucking state. If you add all those up, let's say I've got a rental house and, you know, my pay, that puts me in the top tax bracket. I'm paying upwards of 60% of my income to the state. So yeah, the French tax burden is re-fucking-diculous. I mean, the American one is too, but the French one is really bad. And this is one of the reasons. Now you're not seeing in the yellow vest thing. You're probably not seeing too many people who are in the top tax bracket. So let me pull up these brackets again and see what it takes to pay in 30%. 27,000 euros a year. 27,000. 27,000 euros a year paying in 30%. Let me put that in the 30,000 a year. $30,000 a year. 30% already at $30,000. That's insanity, right? $30,000 a year in the US, again, depending upon where you live, where I live, $30,000 a year is livable, but it's not great. That's a bad job where I live. $30,000 a year. There are jobs that pay less. You get down around 20 and it's like, how do you survive? You can, but how? Right? Which is about make. But it's like, it's you get up to 30 and you're kind of okay, you can live, right? And you start getting higher than that and you start to get a little more comfortable. But $30,000 a year, you're already in the 30% tax bracket in France. Let's look at the United States. Let's look at the 2018 tax brackets in the United States. So let's just say for unmarried and single family, blah, blah, blah. At 38,000, you break into the 22% bracket. $38,700 a year. And you break into the 22% tax. That's more money at less tax than the French currently have. So yeah, it makes sense that these people are burning fucking Paris down. I would be too. Because that tax burden is insane. That's not to say, again, it goes without saying that taxation is theft, all that stuff. Yes, yes, yes. Indeed. However, if you got to choose, you're taking the 22, not the 30, right? These people have to take the 30. That is mathematically worse. the tax burden in France is insane. And by the way, they're also having to pay those same social things. So if they're salaried, they've got they're paying 40%, making $30,000 a year, converted to dollars, $30,000 a year, paying 40%, 9.7% salary tax. That is insane. So it makes perfect sense that these people are out in force. Now let's talk about what actually happened. One of the things that happened here, now this was of course about gas price hikes, because they were going to raise, it was going to be a, basically, it was about global warming. They were going to change people's behavior, make them stop wanting to buy gas by making gas very expensive. Now, this works in the city, because in the city, nobody drives. Not in the city, everybody drives. You have to drive. So people in rural France and people in the lower classes who can't afford to not drive everywhere, because maybe transport's expensive where they are or something like that. This was going to hurt them. This was, in fact, one of the most regressive taxes you could possibly do. Because poor people need transport. I mean, they have more limited options for transport than rich people. So it was an incredibly regressive tax. And they're paying for it now. Well, so what happened is everybody came out in force because this thing wasn't going to happen. Originally just protesting. Then they started burning fucking cars. And they started, you know, breaking shop windows and rioting. Now the French are, they can be professional fucking rioters. They are so good at this. They were burning cities down. And Macron said, okay, fine, as we read. Macron said, okay, fine, we'll push it off for 6 months. And everyone says, no, 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 fuck you. Now, about this time, other groups start joining. And this becomes a protest not just about gas tax hikes, but also about every other social ill in France. You have people like that timeline said farmers weren't going to go in and do their thing. That students came in and complained about their situation too. This became less about gas tax hikes and more about a social revolution. In some cases, a socialist revolution. Because it very much is. And socialists are not really turning out for Macron the way that they were right before he was elected, especially on Twitter. Looking at some of the socialists and looking at translated tweets and things like that, people see Macron as like a weak-ass neoliberal. Right? And he's a member of the Socialist Party. So he's not quite commie enough for people. But this is a big problem. And that's why it didn't stop when Macron said, okay, we're not going to do the gas tax hike. We're not going to do it. Forget about it. Now go home. And everyone said, no, no, no. This is more than that now. It's almost like when you're in an argument with your significant other and you think you're arguing about a specific thing and they are arguing about every single thing you did that week that annoyed them. And so you address the thing that you think you're arguing about, and they're still mad. Why? Because it wasn't about that. It was never about that. It was about every single thing you did that was annoying that week. I'm sure many people have been in those kinds of arguments. I certainly have. Not a lot of great communication in our previous relationship. Anyway, so that's basically what I wanted to get into, is talking about what exactly this is, and to warn people. Because while I am a fan of French riots, I don't know, it's like sports for me. I really dig a French riot. There's nothing better than a good old-fashioned French riot. And they're fun to watch. And a lot of times, the French are particularly good about breaking government shit. They're particularly good. They freaking burned down, it was G-Man on Twitter posted a picture that they had burned down speed cameras. And I was like, fuck yes, do more of that. They tend to be pretty good. They break every other things, and they burn a lot of cars, but they tend to break a lot of government shit, which for me is the best kind of riots, one where you just break government shit, because it's yours anyway. Break it if you want to. But I do want to point one thing out. This was posted on Target Liberty, and it's written by Daniel McAdams. It's basically an open letter. It says, "Greetings, Bob. Just wanted to write you on your most recent piece on the Yellow Vest protest in France. It looks like you and I are the only two skeptical people in the world when it comes to this. From David Duke to the labor left, it's all universal praise for this people power revolution in the streets of France, but as you pointed out, what it is exactly they want? No clue. They said they didn't want the gas tax, and Macron canceled it. Normally, you'd declare victory and go home. But as in the other phony revolutions like Ukraine, once a spooked government meets protesters' demands, the protesters just step up the demands. The goal is regime change rather than cancellation of a bad policy. Glad you mentioned Lenin. He understood that the people never rise up to shake off their chains. He realized that was the job of the tightly controlled vanguard, which is not to say that vanguard was above manipulating the people into believing they were part of the revolution, but things must be carefully and with absolute discipline put into place beforehand. Frankly, I'm shocked at how so many sound observers I know have fallen for this hook, line, and sinker. Okay, we get it. Macron is a scumbag. The faux people power revolt absolutely demands that the target be fully demonized for the people to feel like a great victory was at hand for the average Joe at the expense of the designated bad guy who may well be a bona fide bad guy. Was it that long ago that many of these same people were going gaga over the exact scenario playing out in Egypt against bona fide bad guy Mubarak? The whole Arab Spring was a cover-up launched largely by the likes of Hillary Clinton's State Department, Smart Power. See, that was the operation of Smart Power. And what happened when the big bastard Mubarak was deposed? Democracy and Switzerlandization of the country? Not at all. A legitimately elected Muslim Brotherhood president who was then overthrown with U.S. help in the installation of a kind of mini Mubarak. Round and round we go, yet otherwise sane people believe something has been achieved. Tunisia? Don't make me laugh. In Syria and Libya? Arab Spring? People power? So here it comes again, only this time in France. But people believe it's genuine. Not for any reason other than they want it to be genuine. It's a perfect cook-up to forestall any real populist or anti-establishment conclusion in France, and I guarantee if Macron goes, he'll be replaced by another, perhaps slightly lower-profile member of the status quo political establishment. But some libertarians are convinced it's a libertarian anti-state revolution. The left is convinced it's a workers' revolt. Others see it as an alt-right revolt against the bankers. And the David Duke people may even see it as a pushback against Jewish bankers. They see it actually as a pushback against immigration. But how the hell can it be all of these at once? It's a magical thing that appears exactly as those who gaze upon it wish it to look. Sorry, that's crazy, and I ain't buying it. Anyway, sorry to be so long-winded. Cheers, Daniel. So, Daniel McAdams wrote this thing after seeing a lot of libertarians like, yeah, fucking yellow vest, go for it! Which, by the way, is a sentiment that I agree with. Yeah, fucking yellow vest, go for it. Again, I love a good French riot. But we should not be duped by this thing. Yes, there are some libertarian-leaning people in it, but there are also straight-up commies who are a part of it, and there are freaking neo-Nazis involved in this thing. This is not, which is the point that I was trying to make earlier on when I said that everybody glommed onto this. This is not about freedom, and this isn't about libertarianism. This isn't even about anarchism. This is about whatever the person there, the individual in the group, thinks it's about. So students think it's about student issues. Farmers think it's about farmers' issues. Socialists think it's about establishing better socialism. Neo-Nazis think it's about immigration, think it's about the Jews. There is no united front here. In all of the reading that I did, in all of the stories that I put up, in all the tabs that I had open for hours, I found nothing that looked like a united front. And in fact, the one thing that we did see come out of it, that list of demands that's over this cartoonish clip art yellow vest, some of those are contradictory to one another. There's no real movement here. And I hate to say that, but this is just venting. This changes nothing. This is going to change nothing. It's just steam has built up. Now it's releasing and everything will be back to normal before too long. Hell, maybe Macron does get deposed, but I agree with Daniel McAdams. It's not going to make a difference. This is not a change. And in fact, I found one very interesting piece that was written by Nobel laureate economist Jean Triol. Nobel Prize winner Jean Triol, a rise in the SMIC is not desirable. Basically what he's saying in this piece, and I'll put a link to this because it's, I tweeted it already, but I think I'll drop a link to this one. For him, I'm just going to read this quote, the tax cuts to constant public service require to complete the still, this is a bad machine translation, I'm sorry, to complete the still incomplete reforms of the labor market and education and to undertake the sides of pensions, tax loopholes, and of course the state to make it more effective. The revolt of the yellow vests is an opportunity to recreate the consent to the tax. Nothing changes from this because there's no goal or because everybody has different goals. It would be okay if everybody had different goals if everybody was an anarchist. If everybody who had a yellow vest on was an anarchist, then yeah, having different goals makes sense because you're all going to be different anarchists, but the main thing you want to do is get the fuck rid of the government. But there's nothing like that here. There's nothing like that here. The French are just letting off steam. They got rid of those taxes that they wanted to get rid of, and a couple other policy things may change, but all in all, this affects nothing. And I'm sad to say that, because, like I said, I love a good French riot. I love a good French revolution. But this isn't, and it's certainly not one that I could get behind morally or ethically, because if anyone's going to come out of this thing more powerful, it's the socialists. the state socialists. These spread the wealth kind of motherfuckers. So there's really nothing to be done about it, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know. Basically, it's just this.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
And they go burn a car, and then they feel better. I really wanted to believe this was going to be something bigger, but it's not. It's not. I don't think there's a way. There's no united front for it. So, that's kind of a downer, I know. But, yeah. I think it's important that we know what things are. And the sooner the better. And this is a release valve. This isn't a revolution. This is the water's hot and the teapot's whistling, and now it's going to be over. Very reminiscent of Occupy. Cryptic Cynic points out that it's reminiscent of Occupy Wall Street. He points that out in the chat. Yes, very reminiscent. It's exactly that. I mean, how many bankers went to jail? How many congressmen who told the banks, the housing committee, everybody forgets this, but the housing committee was responsible for making the rules and making the guidance that told the banks to give out bad loans. That was the housing committee and the legislature. They were responsible for that. Everybody decided to blame the bankers. And sure, it was stupid of the bankers to give bad loans, but they were doing what the government told them to do. How many congressmen are in jail for giving bad investment advice to bankers? Nobody. How many bankers are in jail for making loans that they knew were bad loans? None of them. So, yeah, it's exactly like Occupy Wall Street. Nothing fucking changed. And I think that's the exact case here. It's just got a few more fires in. So, it's sports. Watch it, eat the popcorn, and then when it's over, it'll be over. These kinds of release valves, I mean, people have written in political theory about these kinds of release valves already. Anyway, I mean, this is a known thing. People rioting is a known quantity when you're in power. If you know anything about political science or political theory, and you're going into politics, I mean, it's kind of like, yeah, if your numbers get low enough, expect people to start burning a couple of things, and then they'll wear themselves out eventually. It's like letting a toddler cry. Anyway. I just wanted to dig into that thing a little bit. I wanted to sort of explain what the motivations were, some of what the demands were, you know, all over the place is what they are. I just kind of wanted to explain sort of what I had learned about this and digging into it and looking at the timeline and because nobody mentions the video that kind of kicked this whole thing off. Nobody was mentioning it really before Macron pushed back and then eventually canceled the tax hike. Nobody was talking about this in the U.S. But I think it's going to be over. I don't know when it'll be over. Again, the French are very good rioters. They can riot for a long time. So I don't know when it'll end. If it was the United States, I would say next week. I think this is going to be a little longer than that. It might go up to like the holidays, but I think the holidays might be kind of like a hard stop on this. Cause it's like, no, I'm not rioting. It's Christmas. You know what I mean? Like, I think the holidays might be a hard stop. Certain, if not before. So I hope you didn't have too much faith in the beginning of the libertarian revolution happening with the yellow vests, because it never was going to. It's not. These people are not libertarians. They're certainly not anarchists. A lot of them are just poor people who have been abused by their government and still think that government is the answer to their problems. And if we want to make a difference, we see people like this, we should say, you know, you don't need them. You don't need them. You want them, but they hurt you. You don't need them. Maybe help people understand a little bit better the power that they have over their own lives. Simply through existing. Thank you all so much for listening. That's all I had for this show. It's fascinating times, man. Fascinating times. I'll be back next week with more. I'm not sure what exactly, but certainly more. Thank
you
so much.
Remember, everybody, you can find me on Twitter at DeanOFiles. You can find the network on Twitter at AltNetRadio. You can find this and other shows on Alternative Internet Radio, AIRAD.io. You can find the stuff that I write at The Rogue File, roguefile.com. I want to thank everyone who downloads the show, listens to the show. I want to thank everyone who listens live and hangs out in the chat and keeps me on my toes. I want to thank everybody who donates. Thank you all so much, wonderful producers of Dino Files. If you'd like to be among them, there are many ways to donate. You can find them on the Rogue File or on the Air website. Many different ways to make that happen. We also have a merch store if you'd like something for your money. Thanks so much for listening, and you all have a wonderful week.
This show is part of the Alternative Internet Radio Podcast Network. For more great shows like this, visit AIR at AIRAD.io.